Hey guys and gals, it's Tube Talk on WRCA Radio.
I'm not one of the greedy kind. All of my wants are simple. I know what's on my mind. I'm not until I find what would make your eyes glisten with joy. Now listen, big boy. I wanna be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you alone. Boop-boop-ba-doo. I wanna be kissed by you, just you, nobody else but you. I wanna be kissed by you alone. Papa, my goodness, boy. I wanna be loved by you, just you, nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you alone. I wanna be loved by you, just you, and nobody else but you. I wanna be loved by you.
Boop boop a doo to you too. So from the ridiculous to the sublime.
I love the moonlight. I love the old-fashioned things. The sound of rain upon a window pane. The starry song that April sings. Are passing fancies, but sighing sighs, holding hands, these my heart understands. I'm old fashioned, but I don't mind it. That's how. With me,
I
are passing fancies, but sighing sighs holding hands, these my heart understands. I'm old-fashioned, but I don't mind it. That's how I want to be, as long as you'll agree to stay old-fashioned with me.
Well, I guess that just begs the question, do you feel a little old-fashioned tonight, too? Well, you should, because this is your headquarters for vintage music, quality talk concerning the antique radio hobby, a happy, pleasant respite from your busy week. Thanks for tuning in to Tube Talk. We are here on WRCA 1330 AM, broadcasting from Boston, Mass., overlooking the River Charles. Yes, folks. You've lasted again another week to your favorite program. That was Judy Garland with I'm Old Fashioned, written by Jerome Kern and Johnny Mercer. Very nicely done indeed, with an orchestra conducted by Nelson Riddle. We opened up with Boop Boopy Doo, I Want to Be Loved by You. Helen Kane, orchestra conducted by Leonard Joy. That's from 1928. That's something from the Wayback Machine, huh? And, you know, we talk a lot about radio and radios and repairing radios, and tonight, you know, folks, will probably be no different, because if the recipe works, we keep it. Anyway, though, we talk about Zenith and RCA and Philco, some of the bigger, well-known brands, things we see everywhere at swap meets and people's collections. And, you know, so I thought tonight we'd do a little edumacation hour here. This, I guess, would pass for the monologue for the evening. I'll give you a little information, a little background on a smaller company, lesser known, but yet in its day fairly prolific, a big money maker. And in the 50s, this company made a lot of cash. And as so often was the case, later in the 50s and 60s, the pressure, the costs of materials and labor and the ability to produce things overseas at a lower price meant the death knell for this fine company, the Admiral Corporation. Admiral Corporation was founded in 1934 by Ross David Siragusa as the Continental Radio and Television Corporation. Siragusa had sold his automobile, most of his home furnishings, and invested $3,400 in this new company for the purpose of manufacturing radios. The company was a quick success. Within 2 years, the company's sales exceeded $2 million, and by 1939, revenues topped $9 million. In December 1940, the company was incorporated in Delaware as the Admiral Corporation. During World War II, growth continued with the arrival of contracts for military electronics. After the war, Admiral steered into another field with vast potential, the world of television. In 1949, Admiral produced 400,000 television sets. It made more than 1 million television sets in 1950, and in the following year, it manufactured 5 million. Yes, imagine that. Along with companies such as Dumont and Philco, became one of the leading makers of televisions. During the 1950s, the range of products Admiral produced grew beyond radios and television sets to include phonographs, record changers, electric refrigerators, freezers, room air conditioners, electric ranges, and other consumer products. The company expanded by acquiring distributing companies such as Golden State Appliances in 1952, and by 1954, Admiral had 10 manufacturing plants, yes, manned and staffed by Americans making quality products throughout the United States, and other plants in Canada, Australia, Italy, and Mexico. The 1940s and early 50s were among the best years for Admiral. The growth of the company mirrored the prosperity of post-World War II America. Sales grew from $67 million in 1948 to $251 million in 1953. As a stock, it was one of the high flyers of the period. At the time, growth appeared unlimited. However, in the mid-1950s, labor and material cost began to rise steadily, and increased competition from Japanese imports in the 60s and 70s created problems for Admiral. The company discontinued its dividend for 9 years, starting in 1956. Profits were $10 million in 1956, and by 1966, the company had losses of almost $4 million. During the 60s and 70s, Admiral continued its efforts to reduce overhead costs and increase plant efficiencies, but with little success. Admiral sales grew from $347 million in 1967 to more than $600 million in 1973. However, profits were falling sharply. And in 1971, Admiral sold its color picture tube manufacturing operations to RCA. And in 1973, the company agreed to be acquired by Rockwell International for $78 million. Rockwell later sold off the Admiral domestic appliance business to Magic Chef. You may have seen some of their stuff floating around. You'll still see that Magic Chef name out there. Admiral was also a sponsor, a great sponsor of different radio programs, bringing you the Sunday news program on CBS World News Today. They started using their promotional slogan, America's Smart Set. They're also one of the big advertisers on early television. They sponsored Your Show of Shows, Lights Out, Fulton J. Sheen, Life is Worth Living, and Admiral presents the five-star review, Welcome Aboard. And they also, I guess, were big sponsors of the Notre Dame football games. You know, and just another company that has gone on and beyond into the great, vast black hole that was the American electronics industry. Yeah, it's a little sad, but unfortunately true, but amazing. A guy gets into a business with almost nothing, rides the wave of success, a true American success story. David Ross, Siragusa, and the Admiral Corporation. What do you think of all that, Dino?
Pale moon shining on the fields below. Folks are crooning songs soft and low. Needn't tell me so, because I know it's sleepy time down south. Soft winds blowing through the pine wood tree. Folks down there live a life of ease. When old mammy falls upon her knees, it's sleepy time down south. Steamboats on the river are coming and going, splashing the night away. Hear those banjos ringing, the people are singing, they dance till break of day. The old Southland with its dreamy song takes me back there where I belong. How I'd love to be in my mammy's arms when it's sleepy time way down south. When it's sleepy time down south. Sleepy time down south.
got the young girls all going mad. Young girls say they treat them nice, make Trinidad like paradise, drinking rum and Coca-Cola. Go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar. Oh, you vex me, you vex me. From Chickachickery to Mona's Isle, native girls all dance and smile, help soldier celebrate his leave, make every day like New Year's Eve, drinking rum and Coca. Go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar.
It's a fact, man, it's a fact.
In old Trinidad, I also fear the situation is mighty queer. Like the Yankee girl, the native swoon, when she heard her bingo croon, drinking rum and off, drinking rum and Coca-Cola. Go down Point Cumana, both mother and daughter, working for the Yankee dollar.
It's a fact, man, it's a fact.
Rum and Coca-Cola.
Rum and Coca-Cola.
Well, that's the Andrews Sisters, like I have to tell you. We had a little Dean Martin there as well. So it's about that time, on our way down the hall to that comfy, cozy radio parlor, Ross Hochstrasser joins us tonight on Tube Talk. He is a NEARC member, which is the New England Antique Radio Club. He is our special event coordinator. And Ross, thanks for coming on.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Always a pleasure to be a guest here on Tube Talk.
Well, thank you. And just maybe give us a quick recap. You were fortunate enough to attend the New England Antique Radio Club show up in Brookline, New Hampshire, just over the weekend. And how did it go? I heard there was a pretty good crowd, and the guest speaker was well-received.
Yes, indeed. The weather didn't seem to scare off too many people. Of course, we didn't have any of the outside tailgating, which was unfortunate. The general consensus is that a lot of the people like the outdoor tailgating, and so that was a scratch, but a lot of people showed up. I sold a couple of pieces and was happy with that. I talked to other people that didn't sell anything, which is usually the way it goes. It's a mix of successful stories and unsuccessful stories, so... but generally, people were walking around looking happy and buying radios and selling radios.
Music to our ears. Now, how many folks did a good crowd hang around to hear the speaker at the end of the show? I know that was something we hadn't done before. It was Dr. Ralph Baer, who was one of the pioneers in the early video game business, and I heard he gave a pretty good talk.
Yes, he did. I think there was probably about 25 people sitting there listening to him. And he just kind of sat in a chair with a lapel mic on, hooked up to the PA system, and he just sat there and started rambling on. And oddly enough, he didn't
sounds
talk,
like me.
Yeah, well, or me too. He didn't talk all that much about the video game experiences in his life. He went right back to the beginning. It was talking about during World War One or near the end of World War One, working on radios. He converted some foxhole, or made some foxhole radios out of these three-tube radiation monitors or whatever they were. There was some sort of piece of equipment with three tubes in it, and he rewired the thing and turned it into one was a regenerative oscillator and then a detector and amplifier, and he made radios out of the things for the troops. And he then went on and was chatting about his experiences over in Germany, dealing with military installations and radio equipment and that sort of thing. It was very, very interesting. And he eventually ended up getting out of Germany. I don't think he got out of Germany till after World War II. I could be wrong on that. But he came to the United States and was very successful in the radio and television business here, and was working for a company in research and development and engineering, and in his free time came up with things like table tennis and Simon and things like that. So it was quite an interesting talk. He went on for probably, I'm going to guess, about 45 minutes or so. And for a 92-year-old guy, that's quite a long time to be.
That's
to
great.
To be talking.
That's super. Well, you know, he sounds like a potential guest right there, you know. So, but I'm glad he was on our side. He sounds like a very resourceful man. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, in an article in our Radio Club newsletter, he donated, I think it was a set to the club that he said he had actually brought home from France. I think Adam had made mention of it, but you know what, as often is the case, it escapes me precisely what it was. But I think he did make a nice donation to us as well, so that just sounds very, very well-received, and a nice change of pace for folks who go to the meets. Now, no cheap pun intended, but, you know, I can't ever avoid one. Something near and dear to your heart, Nearfest, is coming up, which is the big amateur radio festival, sort of a Woodstock of amateur radio, so to speak, up in Deerfield, New Hampshire, on May 2nd and 3rd, and I take it you will be in attendance?
Yeah, I don't really have a whole lot of choice in the matter. Not that I would never go. I love Nearfest. It's the high point of my year, or high points. We do it twice a year. And yes, it doesn't look like the weather is going to be all that great at this point, but it usually isn't. You know, it's unusual if we have two nice warm sunny days in a row up there. But yes, it's at the Deerfield Fairgrounds. It's the New England Amateur Radio Festival. And it is kind of like a festival, you know. Once the wheeling and dealing and buying and selling of the day kind of dies down, you enter into sort of a casual, very laid back party atmosphere where you'll walk around, and there'll be people that are still set up at their tables, but they'll have a guitar out and maybe some sort of a beverage.
Ooh.
Coffee or tea or something.
Very nice.
And they'll be relaxing and kicking back and singing and playing music and so forth. We also have at 8 o'clock a jam session that goes on, and anyone who happens to be a musician that wants to jump in, if you bring your guitar or your harmonica or your Hammond B3 or whatever it is you like to play.
I could bring my kazoo.
Or a kazoo, certainly. Didgeridoo, you know, anything you like to play, you can bring it along and get into the jam session. That goes on in a little log cabin building that we like to call the Forum Building, but I'm sure they have some sort of other name for it. But that building gets pretty wound up on Friday night at 8 o'clock, and they go pretty much till midnight.
Wow.
I'm usually not there for the beginning of it. I go out for something called the AM dinner, which is the guys on 75 meter AM have a dinner over in, I think it's Northfield, Northfield, I think is the name of the town, over at Johnson's Dairy Bar. We have a dinner over there that's always interesting.
Sounds very exclusive. So the whole thing sounds super deluxe. Now, are you in charge of the music that will be broadcast at this great event? I had heard that we've gone from sort of a rock music format. Now you've got old-time radio and big band standards and old-time radio shows. Has Ross taken over the airwaves up there?
A little bit. We have a very, very low power. We run just under a watt of power. The original people that ran the station used to broadcast pretty much 80s and 90s progressive rock, and the person that was running the station took a hiatus for a year and threw some sequences that I won't get into here on the radio.
Oh, no, no, we don't have to hear that.
He, at any rate, was no longer there, and the station was essentially just dropped in my lap. And I was up on stage making some announcements last spring, a year ago, and somebody hollered up and complained that they couldn't hear the announcements. And I said, well, turn on your FM radio and listen to the station. And they said, we don't want to listen to that garbage. And that got me thinking. It's like, well, I'm looking around at all these gray-haired old guys, and I'm listening to this 90s progressive rock going, there's a big mismatch.
That's right. Something doesn't fit in that picture.
Something
you're right.
Something doesn't work. So I ran into one of our fellow compatriots in the radio station at the MIT flea market last summer, and I said to him, I says, I think we need to change the format, and I think we need to drop the power level down to a much more manageable level, and we need to get rid of this progressive rock. I said, you might like it, and your buddies might like it, but it isn't about what we want to listen to. It's about what Nearfest wants to listen to. So
you tell them, Russ.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it just makes sense.
Hey, you don't have to be a genius to figure that one out. It sounds like a very successful coup d'etat because I heard that people were enjoying it. So that's
they were, very much so. Thing. I was sneaking some little snippets of Gene Shepherd in there.
All right.
And,
very
know,
good.
Oldies music going all the way back to the big band era. And,
super.
My chief engineer, Tom Summer from Arizona, who flies out twice a year for this event, He popped his head in the trailer and says, I've never heard so many radios on.
The whole idea. Very good. That's a success right there.
Yeah. So we did okay, and we're going to continue in that direction this time and add to our repertoire a little bit and see what we can do. But it's important that we cater to our audience.
That's right.
So they'll listen to us, and then they'll be able to hear our announcements.
Yeah, and make the music match the radio, so that's very cool. It sounds like a blast, and that's Nearfest up in Deerfield, New Hampshire. Check it out. They get a great crowd. People come from all over, and it's something you should put on your radio calendar. So here we are, and usually we sit in the comfy, cozy parlor here and just kind of kick back and chat, but tonight we're actually going to go into Ross's repair shop. We're going to go over to the bench and have a seat and talk about some common problems that any radio man or woman could encounter as they get into their radio restoration work. And again, we urge you all, caution, don't try to restore a set yourself unless you're experienced or have been trained or have a friend who is experienced and competent to help you out. You do not want to harm yourself, your set, your home, so be careful out there. So that's rule number one on the show. But just a few things some that people might hear about as they get into this hobby and they wonder, well, what does that mean, or what's that problem? Or, you know, try to explain some of the issues behind some of the frequently heard terms. So, you know, one that comes up a lot, and, people will say, what's motorboating? You know, I mean, it's not something you do in the summer down off of Green Harbor. So what is motorboating, Ross? What does that mean when we hear some guy complaining about his vintage tube set and a motorboating problem?
Well, motorboating is, it actually is something you can do down in Green Harbor with a little boat, but in this particular case, that's not
stand
what we're
corrected.
Talking
that's
about.
Right.
Motorboating is the technical word for it is parasitic oscillation.
Ooh,
and parasitic oscillation can happen for a number of reasons. Depending upon what vintage radio you're working on, the reasons can vary with that. The most common reason that motorboating happens is because of a failure in a capacitor that's bypassing a cathode resistor. If the cathode resistor that's being bypassed by the capacitor is no longer bypassed by the capacitor, the tube can break into parasitic oscillation or motorboating. You see this normally in audio circuits. Generally, replacing that capacitor will fix the problem. Motorboating can be caused by all sorts of different things. I've had situations where, particularly on these old German radios, where you have multiple loudness taps on the volume control, and the old German volume controls were assembled with little copper rivets, and you can have a rivet break on one of those audio loudness taps, and it can actually cause the audio output stage to break into parasitic oscillation.
Huh.
Sometimes that loudness tap is connected into what we call a negative feedback loop, which is usually a wire that comes right back from the speaker terminal through a resistor capacitor combination through a tone control back to the loudness tap, and you can have the whole audio output stage break into a motorboating situation. And as you turn the volume control, the frequency of the oscillation changes.
So that's something.
Any of the capacitors, and of course, the more complex the audio output stage, the more susceptible you're going to be to motorboating.
I see. Sounds like audio output mayhem is what it sounds like.
It can be really a problem to troubleshoot sometimes too. In the same vein, I was working on a Grundig model, I think it was a 2147, cute little mid-60s vintage, one of the last vacuum tube table radios that Grundig made. And I was sitting here with the thing connected up to my speaker on the bench, and I was having a high-frequency motorboating situation. So instead of it being a thump, 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 thump kind of a sound, it was more of a squeal. And I went over and over and over that circuit and could not find anything wrong with it. And it finally dawned on me that the speaker is a very critical part of the audio output circuit on these German radios. And I was not using the speaker that was in the radio.
I see.
So I disconnected my big Fisher speaker that was on the bench and connected the proper Grundig speaker, and the problem went away.
Voila. Test, trial and error at its best. Let's just hit the pause button here for a moment and remind everyone, I'm Paul Burish. He is Ross Hochstrasser. This is Tube Talk on WRCA Radio, and it's the Technical Bench Night. Now, in an older set, could shielding problems cause this, lack of shielding or shielding? Somebody had told me once that if you didn't have all the tube shields that were in there, sometimes you can get a motorboating issue.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Typically in the IF stages or in the detector stage, if you don't have a shield in place, or if you have a tube that's weak, or if you are working on a super heterodyne set and you have overcoupled the IF transformers, you can get motorboating as well. So there's a zillion and one different occurrences that can cause motorboating to happen, and it can happen in almost any stage in the radio.
Sometimes
you'll find in some radios that you just need to get the tube shield on and then ground the tube shield, and that will take care of the problem. But it's one of the most difficult things in a radio to troubleshoot.
It sounds like a real baffler, because you've got a symptom that could have multiple causes, and then you've got to run through these multiple causes. And is the capacitor the most likely culprit, even though there are many other things that could cause you a problem?
Yep. Yeah, the capacitor is the most likely culprit. But like you say, tube shields, overcoupling can be a problem. And actually, another thing to be very careful of, particularly with some of the high-performance super het radios, lead dress.
Yes, lead dress. You see that? You see that on the schematics and sometimes in the notes. I always used to see that sometimes when I would look at them. Dress leads away from. They give you these tips, and that's important. So
that's why one of the things that I do, particularly in some of these German sets where you've got, or even some of the boat anchors, where you've got a lot going on in a small space in the chassis. If you run into a motorboating or parasitic oscillation situation, you can go in with a plastic tool. Don't try to do it with a screwdriver, but a plastic alignment tool or a chopstick or something, and just go in and start moving things around. If you've gone through and replaced a whole pile of capacitors, you've maybe replaced a resistor or two, go in and just start rearranging the furniture under the chassis, and sometimes just by moving a capacitor away from a resistor or another capacitor or a coil will eliminate the problem.
Very interesting.
In extremely problematic situations, you can actually take a capacitor and wrap it with copper foil and then solder a wire on the copper foil and ground it to isolate that capacitor, and sometimes that will knock out a motorboating problem as well.
Very interesting, very interesting. You know, and one of the other things that you'll sometimes hear people refer to is, you know, 60 hertz hum, or I think sometimes you'll hear people call it mains hum. You know, what exactly is that? I mean, should you hear some hum in the background? I mean, I would guess there's going to be always a certain degree of it, but that's something obviously you wouldn't want to have to listen through if you were trying to pick up a signal.
No, no, and hum is a very tough thing to troubleshoot and to chase down as well. I was working with a friend recently on a Telefunken Opus 6, which is a beautiful 1956 vintage table radio with push-pull, six BQ5s in the output, and six speakers. And he was having a problem with a hum. And long story short, what it was, as we were listening to it, these radios have a full wave rectifier. They actually have a bridge, a selenium bridge rectifier.
Yep.
And so the ripple in the power supply is 120 hertz, not 60 hertz. So if you're chasing down power supply hum, even with a full wave like a 5Y3 rectifier or 5U4, you're going to be listening to 120 hertz and not 60. Well, this Telefunken we were chasing this hum problem down in, it was actually 60 hertz hum. It wasn't 120, which indicated to me that it was not coming from the high-voltage power supply. It was coming from someplace else.
Yep.
And what we discovered, oddly enough, is that Telefunken ran one lead around the chassis for the filament supply, and the other leg of the filament supply was the chassis. So somewhere along the line, the power transformer secondary for the filament supply had to be connected to the chassis.
Right.
Now, the proper way to do that is to have a tab that is part of the chassis that's bent up, and you solder a wire
sure.
to that. And that's the best way to do it. In lieu of doing that, a terminal lug could be riveted or screwed to the chassis, or in this particular case, Telefunken used 9-pin tube sockets that had a metal bracket essentially holding the tube socket in. They were riveted to the chassis, and that little bracket had four little convenience lugs on it for grounding. And Telefunken said, okay, this is where we're going to ground our filament supply. So they grounded the filament supply to that tube socket, tube sockets riveted to the chassis, over years of being stored in the basement or whatever, a little bit of oxidation had formed around the rivets where that
sure.
Filament return was happening to the chassis. So there was maybe a tenth of an ohm or a half an ohm of resistance between that transformer and the chassis. And also connected to that same tube socket, to one of the other convenience ground terminals, was the cathode bypass capacitor. So what was happening was, because it wasn't firmly grounded to the chassis, that filament lead, because there's quite a bit of current flowing in the filament
sure.
circuit, that tube socket was injecting 60 hertz hum through the cathode bypass capacitor into the cathode of the output tube.
Eureka.
Eureka. So it was a matter
was the moment.
Of soldering a jumper lead directly to the chassis from that tube socket, and the problem was solved. Another odd hum problem that I ran into, and this is even more weird than that, I was working on a Saba Freiburg W3, which is a radio that will take your breath away. The sound quality is so amazing. This is a table radio with two 10-inch full-range speakers facing out the front. One of the 10-inch full-range speakers has an electrostatic tweeter